is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think the information about vaccines is being channeled out to the people, but at the same time, there is also a counter misinformation and disinformation as well, which is all over social media.
That was Norman Matara of the group Zimbabwe Doctors of Human Rights on the causes of hesitancy getting the COVID-19 vaccine. Details coming up also. There are reports that Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau is dead or seriously wounded. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Scientists working to slow the spread of malaria are hoping that reducing the disease's primary spreaders, mosquitoes, will save lives. Henry Wilkins has more from Burkina Faso.
The mosquito-borne disease malaria kills more than 400,000 people each year, the vast majority in Africa. Target Malaria, an international group of scientists, is working in Burkina Faso on a genetic solution. Abdoulaye Diabate is with the West Africa country's Research Institute for Science and Health. He says the objective of Target Malaria is to develop a genetic control tool specifically applied to mosquitoes to be able to drastically reduce or eliminate the density of mosquitoes. The scientists are genetically modifying mosquitoes so their offspring will be only male, and any females they mate with after release will also produce just males. Since only female mosquitoes spread malaria, the disease should drop off quickly along with their population. In Bana village, where the genetically modified mosquitoes were tested in 2019, locals were initially worried about the experiment. Kiesiara Sanu, a Bana village elder, says that at the beginning, people thought the survey would release mosquitoes in the village that could cause more diseases. But since working with Target Malaria, they've come to understand exactly what the purpose is and now even help them with tasks like collecting the mosquitoes. Genetically modified mosquitoes are just one malaria solution that has been tested in Burkina Faso. The country also pioneered pesticide-infused mosquito nets. Oxford University's Jenner Institute in April announced that a malaria vaccine tested in Burkina Faso had a breakthrough 77% efficacy. Target Malaria says climate and environment play a large part in the country's cutting-edge malaria research. Naima Sykes of Target Malaria says the WHO 2019 World Malaria Report said that over 94% of malaria cases and deaths took place in Africa.
Therefore, when seeking out institutions to partner with, Target Malaria sought out institutions in countries with significant malaria burden and a strong desire to do something about it.
The West African Organization for Coordination and Cooperation in the Control of Major Endemic Diseases was set up in the 1960s and headquartered in Burkina Faso. The Research Institute's Diabate points out that its scientists are the third generation of malaria researchers. When you grow up in Burkina Faso's environment, malaria becomes part of your daily life, and it can make you think that it's inevitable that you'll have it. But when I went to school, my mind opened up, and I soon realized what the source of the problem is. Thanks to researchers' hard work, says Diabate, Africa's deadly malaria problem is closer to being solved. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Bobo Dioulasso, Burkina Faso.
Ethiopia's twice delayed national elections have been rescheduled for June 21st. Electoral Board Chairwoman Burtukan Medexa cited logistical woes related to tasks like training electoral staff and distributing ballot papers. The new election date was revealed at a press conference by Electoral Board spokesperson Solania Shimelis, following meetings with the government, opposition parties, and regional officials. During a call to Tunisian President Kais Saied last week, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris says she expressed support for economic reforms as the country emerges from the challenges of COVID-19. The two leaders also reaffirmed the importance of democratic institutions, the rule of law, and the fight against corruption. Mongi Daoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi the message that the U.S. is sending.
The phone call between President Kais Saied and Vice President Kamala Harris was actually the first direct contact that President Saied had with the White House since he was elected. It came while Tunisia is going through unprecedented economic and financial crisis. This crisis is directly related, of course, to the pandemic, but also it's created from a political crisis that is directly related to the president, Kais Saied. You know, as we remember, when the government tried to reshuffle and make changes in its formation, Kais Saied refused to allow that change to go through. Also, the parliament tried to establish the constitutional court. Kais Saied refused to sign the law, and right now we are into that impasse. And that's why she emphasized in the call that Tunisia must work together. We can only think that she's pointing to the crippling of the government. She emphasized that Tunisia must work together to overcome this economic crisis and emphasized the importance of democratic institutions. We think that she's talking about the constitutional court.
The U.S. Vice President also tweeted, "We stand with Tunisia as it makes the economic reform necessary to recover from the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic." What's your own assessment of the Tunisia government plan for economic reform?
As Tunisia is engaged right now with the discussions with the IMF, Tunisia government did not actually make its plans available to the public. And everybody in Tunisia knows what the IMF has been asking for, what are the reforms requiring of the Tunisian government to do. And they are mainly addressing the bloated public sector that needs to be reduced and reduce the burden of the wages. Also, there's a need to have a plan to move to a targeted subsidies directed at the low-income families, rather than having a costly and blanket subsidies that benefits many Tunisians who do not need it. The third important part in that plan is to privatize some of the publicly owned companies that have been operating at a loss to the Tunisian government. However, the UGTT, which is the largest labor union in Tunisia, has expressed frustration with the government, especially in terms of its lack of transparency in dealing with the negotiations with the IMF. So I think the biggest problem that the government is going to have after convincing the IMF of its plan of reform is actually to convince the UGTT and other partners in Tunisia to come along and agree to its plan so it can be a realistic way to move forward and to implement these plans.
The Associated Press said that Tunisia is currently reporting the highest number of new COVID-19 deaths per capita in Africa. How do you explain that?
After a relative success that Tunisia has experienced at the beginning of the pandemic, where the government was able to bring the numbers down to almost zero infection rate, no casualties at all, after that, we saw, you know, things got worse. Tunisia, like you said, right now is the worst in Africa in terms of numbers per capita. This is directly related to the complacency that many, after seeing the numbers go down, they just abandon all the precautions that the government have put in place. Also, the political crisis. We saw two governments have been replaced. We saw three health ministers have exchanged place. And so all of that have reflected negatively on the situation in Tunisia, and we find ourselves right now in this dire situation where the hospitals are operating at a maximum capacity, where there's a lack of oxygen. We saw Algeria, we saw other countries extend some needed help to Tunisia and to provide them with some medical equipment, oxygen, and so forth. And so Tunisia needs to get its act together. The government and the president need to resolve this gridlock so Tunisia can move forward.
That was Mongi Daoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. The French news agency AFP says Nigeria's Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau has been seriously wounded after trying to kill himself to avoid capture during clashes with rival Islamic State allied jihadists in the north of the country. Shekau's Boko Haram faction and fighters for the Islamic State West Africa province, ISWAP, have been battling in northeastern Borno State, where ISWAP has become the dominant force in Nigeria's more than a decade-long jihadist insurgency. Nigeria's news sites and social media on Thursday were filled with rumors and unconfirmed reports about the death of Shekau. Shekau made headlines when his men kidnapped nearly 300 schoolgirls in 2014. This is not the first time he has been reported killed or seriously wounded. If confirmed, his loss could be a huge blow to Boko Haram, already weakened by airstrikes on its bases and defections of his fighters. Zimbabwe's hopes that it was bringing COVID-19 under control have been undercut by reports that the variant first reported in India has arrived. The country has put in place new measures to guard against a possible new wave at a time when vaccine rollout has been met with hesitancy. Travelers from India are expected to be tested upon arrival. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi probes the hesitancy in the vaccine uptake.
Monica Mutsangwa is the Minister of Information. She gives the latest numbers on the COVID-19 situation in Zimbabwe.
As of 16th May 2021, a total of 591,808 people had received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccines, and about 222,450 had received their second dose. This is across the country. Members of the public are urged to go to their nearest health facility to receive their COVID-19 vaccines so that the country achieves the required herd immunity to control the spread of this global pandemic.
Zimbabwe started its vaccination drive in February. Experts are worried about the weak public interest. Dr. Nomen Matara is with the group Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights.
I think the information about vaccines is being channeled out to the people, but at the same time, there is also a counter misinformation and disinformation as well, which is all over social media. So I think that is what is causing people to become hesitant in terms of taking up the COVID-19 vaccine. Although the information is coming out, we have also seen that some people are saying they actually do not trust the government, that they are going to provide them with safe and effective vaccines, even though that claim has no basis.
Tinotenda Chambwe is a Harare resident who is yet to receive his vaccine. He explains his hesitancy.
There are lots of stories that are coming out of these vaccinations. You hear some have reacted to the vaccinations, so I do prioritize my health first. I also believe that government is not giving much information, so I can't even trust the government on the part of vaccinations. I also feel that the variants that are coming, like now we have the Indian variant. Yeah, how effective are the vaccines? That casts so much doubt on the effectiveness of the vaccines.
Matara says all opinion leaders need to rally behind the fight against misinformation. But while the government has been a formal source of information during the pandemic, citizens have developed mistrust of official pronouncements. And government critics claim the government has used lockdown measures to tamp down on dissent. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Spain has returned 6,600 of the 8,000 Moroccan migrants who swarmed or jumped over border fences into the Spanish city of Ceuta, setting off a diplomatic row. Reuters quotes Spanish Interior Minister Fernando Grande Marlaska as saying the situation is back to normal. No fresh arrivals were recorded for the second day in Ceuta, the Spanish city of 85,000, at the center of the dispute between Spain and Morocco. It all started when Morocco started loosening its border control with Spain as retaliation for Spain hosting Western Sahara independence leader Brahim Ghali. Ghali, who Morocco considers a terrorist, has been recovering from COVID-19 in a hospital in northern Spain since April 18th. A Liberian senator leader has told VOA he was shocked when the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia issued a statement referring to him as a notorious warlord. The statement yesterday came after the Senate elected Prince Y. Johnson, chair of the Liberian Senate Committee on Defense and Intelligence. Yesterday, Johnson called James Butty, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa, to complain about the statement, saying it was unjust and violated his rights. He also said that he has attended functions at the U.S. Embassy several times over the past several years as a member of the Senate. Johnson was a rebel leader during Liberia's civil conflict at the head of the Independent National Patriotic Front of Liberia and was known for killing critics. His troops captured and murdered President Samuel Kaido in September 1990, and a video taken at the time showed him celebrating Doe's torture. The embassy said the Senate's decision to raise Johnson to a leadership role creates doubts about the seriousness of the Senate as a steward of Liberia's defense and security. Johnson told Butty he is not afraid of a push to establish a war crimes court in Liberia, but he said Liberia's laws prevent the creation of such a court. Botswana says it will vaccinate scores of illegal immigrants from neighboring Zimbabwe for COVID-19. Most cross the border in search of jobs, and there are fears that they could miss out on the injections. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokadishi Dube has the details.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Frederick Shaba, says Botswana has assured all Zimbabwean immigrants that they'll be vaccinated against COVID-19. Shaba met his Botswana counterpart, Lemogang Kwape, in Gaborone this week.
We were informed by the Minister of Botswana that it is their government policy to vaccinate all Zimbabweans in Botswana. And we are very appreciative of this gesture.
Shaba says in return, Zimbabwe will also inoculate Botswana nationals living along the border between the two countries.
Similarly, we understand, although I don't have statistics right now, we understand that there are also non-Zimbabweans on our various boundary points, sometimes who cross into Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwe is ready to also vaccinate those people.
But some Zimbabwean immigrants like Jerome Spanda are concerned they might be at the tail end of the vaccination program.
So there are forms that we need to fill in, and it's a problem because we have to indicate our residence permit numbers when we fill in these forms. So because we are illegal immigrants, we're concerned that this will delay our vaccination.
Botswana receives thousands of undocumented immigrants from Zimbabwe, mostly are fleeing economic hardships in their homeland. Zimbabwe's vaccination program is ahead of its regional neighbors, with nearly 3% of the population having received the jab, according to Ethiopia-based Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
The importance of having a digital skill set in today's world of the internet and social media has become more critical than ever for employees and employers alike. For example, in Nigeria, the demand for digital skills is at an all-time high. Africa's 54th technology correspondent, Paul Ndiho, via Skype, spoke to Omo Clark, founder and CEO, iBase, a Lagos-based digital products agency specializing in web and software application developments and training in Lagos, Nigeria.
You've been in the technology sector for a while. You do software development and a lot more. Let's start there.
Basically, what I do is build software solutions, software products, you know. So I run a digital products agency. We say we build for ourselves, but not really. We build for our community, and then we build for businesses as well.
Is a software development a big business in Nigeria?
Software development in Nigeria is still, what I would say, in its infancy. You know, we're not there yet, if I call it that. Software is big business, because obviously a lot of companies' businesses run on software solutions, you know. So from that perspective, software development market is really, really huge, you know, put it that way. But do we build it ourselves then? So that's the other part of it.
What kind of software do you build for your clients? Do you even build the hardware to go along with that software, or it's just a software development?
We focus on software. So we don't touch hardware, you know, too much. We can advise on it and consult. There's a lot of people, a lot of businesses don't understand tech. So we can advise on that, but we build software solutions. So the kinds of things that we've typically built, we've built for different companies across industries. So we're not like focused on fintech or focused on something like that. We build across board. So we've built for the first thing that came to my mind, health tech. You know, we build for hospitals, dentists, you know, different sorts of applications to help them do their business better, help customers communicate, reach them better. We've built for education institutions, you know, we've built for, I mean, you name it. We've built for travel, for businesses in the travel industry. We've built for NGOs, you know, we've built for charity organizations. All across, we've done work for the government as well.
Most businesses were affected by the coronavirus pandemic. I'm just curious, at what extent was your business affected by this global shutdown and the pandemic?
From that perspective, in my business, we got a lot of work, you know, a lot of businesses wanting to get online, get websites, start selling online, doing all of that. We got that. But on the flip side of it, because of like infrastructural challenges we have in Nigeria, we were impacted. Yes, we saw a lot of work. I was busy throughout the lockdown working, doing a specific thing, i.e. building really web applications for people, helping them get online so they can work, so they can sell, reach their customers and all that, and doing training, you know, so we're training people on digital skills, training all these businesses that never really used the internet before, training them on digital marketing skills. But on the flip side, our capacity was limited, you know, because I had staff that didn't have power to work from home. They didn't have the ability to work from home. So we could only take on so much work.
Nigeria has become sort of a go-to place for software development. All these international tech giants are running to Nigeria, especially Lagos, where you are. Seems to attract these international companies to come to Lagos to tap into the talent there?
I think the fintech space in Nigeria is vibrant, you know. A lot of fintech companies like Flutterwave, you've heard of them, Paystack, they're doing so well. And there's this huge talent pool, you know. We have a youth population in Nigeria, so many young people in Nigeria trying to do stuff. So I think that's an attractive market.
Besides being a software developer, you also created a company that brings young, talented people together. Speak more to that.
In Nigeria, it's difficult to get handymen, you know, competent ones to come and do stuff for you. And it was a general problem that affects everybody in Nigeria, really. Everybody has an artisan story. So what we do is we register tradespeople, people, I think somebody coined the phrase, that work in the informal sectors, often forgotten, often neglected. Many reasons behind that. You can go and say, I'm looking for a plumber in Ikoyi, in Lagos, you know, to come and do stuff. And it shows you all the people that have registered and then you can come. So it's a huge ongoing stuff we're doing, but it's really to organize, digitize that market so that people can, you know what I mean? It's a two things. So they can get job because they have problems getting work, and you, whoever is sitting in their homes, in their offices, can find somebody quickly.
That was Africa's 54's tech correspondent, Paul Ndiho, speaking to Omo Clark, founder and CEO, iBase, based in Lagos, Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.